Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances. We're talking about working money doesn't suck. And so we don't get sued. This is for entertainment purposes only.
And find even more entertainment on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Or follow our individual accounts. Matter of fact, and follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with one T on Twitter, two T's everywhere else. Rich can be found at I am Rich Jones.
I am.
And don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you can receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more. And we've also partnered with NerdWallet for all your personal finance needs. For more information, visit paychecksandbalances.com/tools.
Yeah. I love some of these calculators. And yo, they make it super easy in terms of being able to figure out payoff dates, savings amounts, all that good stuff. And I know just in general, we've been looking at what type of tools we can provide to listeners, things that we use, things that we found. So I definitely encourage people to drop by that link and check it out. And this is also our last episode of 2017. It's been a great year for the podcast. Saw each other three times in 2017. Spoke at two conferences. We've had some great features, some great opportunities that have come about. And I feel like there's stuff that we've done that we haven't talked about on the episodes that we probably should have, but we'll probably do a better job of that. Or we will, not probably, we will do a better job of highlighting some of these other things and happenings in 2018. And yeah, I'm glad we were able to go strong this year and get a lot of positive feedback and feel like we're actually impacting some lives, man. And so at this point, we've been doing this for over 4 years now, which is crazy.
Senior millennials representing. And I do keep a running list, not of everything, but some of the highlights if folks would like to see where all we've been, not only in 2017, where we might be in 2018 and where we were in 2016 at debtfreeordietrying.com/news. It's just a kind of a running log of what's going on with the show, the book, articles, and basically where you can find us around the interwebs.
And so you also want to point out that's like your site. Because people are probably like, wait, but it's Paychecks and Balances. DebtFreeOrDieTrying.com. What podcast is that? I'm confused.
Yeah, it's not a podcast. It's actually a static web page that I kind of maintain in the background. That's why I don't plug it as much. Because frankly, I'm too lazy to maintain two websites.
I totally get it.
For those who maintain websites, you know that struggle. And speaking of which, before starting the show, shout out to my Uncle Charles, dog. Actually, he is not my uncle, but Charles did leave us a voicemail, and you can do the same, and you might get shout out too by visiting paychecksandbalances.com and clicking that send voicemail button. Appreciate you, Charles. Just another way to reach your friendly neighborhood personal finance guys.
And it's super easy. You don't got to be on a fancy microphone. You can be on your cell phone, a tablet, at your computer. If you want to write a little script for yourself before you leave us a voicemail, do that. But yeah, we love hearing from listeners in any format possible. So also, if you have questions for us, topics you'd like to see us cover in the 2018 or have up for consideration, info@paychecksandbalances.com. So what's good for today's show, good brother?
I just realized some of the junior millennials might not get that. So to my senior millennials, I say boom, 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 boom. On today's show, we had a great combo with Michael Hobbs, the author of Generation FML. It's not as depressing as it sounds. There's a lot of facts, but we also have a happy ending. No pause.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I know we'll talk a little bit more about it on the back half of the show, but super engaging. We haven't talked to a ton of folks who do journalist type things, but yo, I won't lie. Some of the stats like had my head swimming for a bit. I was just like, all these numbers, and I'm like, how am I going to remember all this? And I'm like, well, we have show notes, and like I can go back and listen to this and jot stuff down. But I also thought, just in terms of the conversation, did a great job of like keeping it light, keeping it informative, and all of the things that have made the podcast go this year. So, yeah, that's my take.
We end 2017 on a strong one. Looking for 2018. Enjoy. Today, we welcome Michael Hobbs. Michael is a fellow senior millennial of 35 years of age who wrote that one article that all your millennial friends were talking about. Well, the cool ones on Twitter anyway. And Mr. Hobbs, not to brag, is also from and lives in Seattle. He worked in human rights, and now some people confuse him for some sort of journalist. He was also on NPR once. And so we're happy he was willing to take a step back in his career to join us on Paychecks and Balances today. Welcome, Michael. Did we miss anything from your illustrious background?
I think that's the highlights. It was being born, growing up in Seattle, and being on NPR. I think that's about it.
I mean, that's actually more than some. You know what?
That's
I won't
not
go.
Bad, yeah.
I'll start on a positive note, you know, because we got a lot of deep facts that we're going to have to hit today. So that article was, quote, "Millennials are screwed. Why millennials are facing the scariest financial future of any generation since the Great Depression." So did you come up with this? I'll tell you, I sent this to the fellas in the group chat that we maintain. And even Rich commented, yeah, that's a great article. Like, we all clicked in and started reading. Did you have anything to do with that title? Was that what your original pitch was?
I wanted it to be generation screwed, but not screwed, like the slightly more strong version of that term. But then my editors were like, no, we can't put like a giant swear word on the front page of Huffington Post. So we compromised on generation screwed. That really is like where it started out from. I mean, the whole thing kind of began with, I think, the conversation that like every millennial is having with their parents over the last couple of years, this like little kind of comments that you get from your parents' generation of like, oh, you guys can't settle down. You're all living with your parents. Like, maybe if you weren't playing video games, you would like be able to buy a house, this kind of stuff. And it just, you know, I'm like a total nerd and I started looking into the statistics and it's like the minute you do any work or like have any interest in what's actually going on with young people, you realize that like it really isn't the fact that like we're all playing Pokemon Go and like not learning how to code. Like, there's no evidence for that viewpoint, and there's really no evidence for the viewpoint that like we're more spoiled than previous generations or like we're dumber, like less financially literate than other generations. I think 25-year-olds have kind of always been financially illiterate. So it's not really anything new that like we're not super interested in our pension plans right now. So I just like, it almost started as kind of like this rebuttal to like all the conversations that I was having that like, it's actually really hard out there for us and in like measurable ways that our parents don't seem to understand. And so one of the most interesting things that's happened since it came out is I'm getting all these emails from boomers that are like, oh my God, I had no idea. Like, I had no idea that you have to work 4,400 hours at minimum wage to afford college education. Whereas for my generation, it was 300 hours. Like, they just don't know this. There hasn't been like a cultural conversation for that generation about how much harder it is for their kids than them. And so I sort of thought of it as like partly for millennials that like we should be armed with our actual statistics, like what's really going on with us, but then also kind of like awareness raising among boomers and Xers that like, it's actually really hard for us out there. And like, we can try to come together on like trying to fix all this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do want to note that you did get FML on the homepage there. So I feel
that's
like,
that
was a, you know, I saw that. That was like glowing letters. So I feel
it's
like
the little victories. Yeah.
And I just realized that we probably made like 3 federal watch lists because you use evidence based in there. And that has been banned this
that's
week.
True.
So
yeah. So hello to the NSA who's listening to this now.
We'll see what happens.
Wait. So how was that banned? I feel behind.
Evidence-based and science-based were banned from use by the CDC, by the presidential administration. I'm not even sure if I'm allowed to say his name. I'm not going to name drop, you know what I'm saying? Not on a first name basis. Mm-hmm. But your boy banned evidence-based and science-based from use at the CDC, among 5 other words that I can't all recall right now.
Yeah, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I'll talk to you about that after the show.
But speaking of, since we're already on the watch list and being monitored by the NSA, the evidence-based information, you said you researched on Twitter for 8 months, actually. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the inspiration. Is there anything that you found surprising? Did you learn something that even you didn't know as a fellow senior millennial?
I mean, it was like every day was like something new. I think the biggest thing for me, and I think this is like my privilege coming out, is like the insane just Kafka-esque nature of like the safety net in America. Like meeting all these people that are like on food stamps, on welfare. I spent a lot of time at this homeless shelter in Seattle, and just like how dehumanizing it is to get on welfare and how much easier it was for previous generations, like TANF, temporary assistance to needy families. You used to just like give mothers money, like for if you had a child under 6, you just like get a check in the mail. And like it wasn't that difficult to get on. And now it's like to get money from temporary assistance for needy families. First of all, it's only like $400 a month. So it's really not that much of a help. It's like that's like half your rent if you live in a big city. Secondly, it's like you have to sign this thing called an individual responsibility plan, which is like really dehumanizing. It's this thing where you have to say like, I promise to spend every penny of my money getting vocational education, getting training, buying like beans and rice for my children. Cause like heaven forbid I like take us out for a meal or like make something fun for them. You know, it's like just the level of difficulty of getting any form of assistance, and that it always comes with this like shaming aspect to it, where it's like, you really need to prove to us that you're like an actual saint And if you have any mistakes, if you give in to impulse one time in your life, like, we'll cut everything from you. And like, you should feel bad about yourself. As someone who has like not been on welfare in my life, just talking to people who have had to navigate this terrible system for so long was just really, really, really eye-opening. And now I'm like really depressed that I didn't know that before. Like that has been something that I just had no idea how difficult it was.
And why did you choose that audience? Were you driven there? Was it a natural occurrence? Is that who you went to first?
Well, I think also, I mean, that came from the numbers too, that when I first started, I was thinking this would be more about student debt and more about like those kind of left behind people that you hear about that kind of went to college, did everything right, but are really struggling. And like, that's obviously a huge problem, but that's kind of like the problem that we talk about a lot with millennials. Whereas we don't really talk about like millennial single moms, but like 42% of millennial women are mothers. And we don't talk about millennial mothers all that much. And we don't talk about like how much harder it is for them. And we don't talk about like minimum wage workers. And we don't talk about, you know, 83% of millennials who are unemployed only have a high school degree. So if you're a millennial without a college degree, which is 66% of millennials, it's like really hard in this country to kind of make it, to kind of get into a career, to get onto the ladder. And again, that's the majority of millennials don't have college degrees. And so for me, it was about kind of like correcting this idea that like, you know, college has become harder and more expensive. Yes, but there's a lot of kids that was never an option for them anyway. And those kids have it even worse. And so the first thing I did was start to look around of like, okay, where are like the poor young people in this country? Where can I meet poor young people? So I spent a day at this friend of mine works at a community college. So I like carpooled down with her and just like hung out at this community college all day, just like talking to kids that were like, that were trying to learn to code and that were trying to like get back on their feet after a setback happened to them. And that was fascinating. I went to like, I mean, because I worked on it for so long, I would like be this like weird guy that when I went to like fast food restaurants, I would like ask people like, hey, how much do you make? Like, can I talk to you afterwards? Like, I would just start to like nosing into people's business and like trying to find out. Like there's all these like invisible structures around, and I wanted to kind of like investigate those structures. So the homeless shelter that I was hanging out at was a youth homeless shelter. It's only for people 18 to 25. And that was another group that I wanted to find out, like what kind of person is homeless between 18 and 25. And it was really interesting what I found. So I just kind of wanted to find those people because like you really don't hear that much about genuinely poor people between 18 and 35.
And along those lines, we had a listener question that I want to highlight. It came in from at A64Aquarian, said the article was spot on. Question, can you ask, is this something that affects Generation X? Are they in the same boat for the most part, or will they have avoided some of the carnage you covered?
Well, it's interesting. I think, I mean, any sort of definition of a generation is like totally arbitrary. Like it's completely like my brother is 2 years older than me and he's technically Generation X and I'm technically a millennial. But like, we're 2 years apart. We grew up in the same household. Like we were subject to the same economic forces fundamentally, right? So I think at the bottom of this, like the concept of generations is like a little bit silly. Whereas I think you can really look at like a cumulative set of economic structures that have been getting worse and worse and worse for a long time now. And so the boomers got a little bit of that. Gen X got a little bit more. We're getting a little bit more. And Generation Z, or whatever we're going to call them after us, they're going to get it even more. And so I think the way to think about it is that there's this kind of like avalanche going through the economy and it's affecting everybody. And, you know, there's going to be huge gradations, huge inequalities within millennials, within Xers, within everybody. But it's bad for everybody and it's happening to everybody. So since the article came out, I've gotten a lot of emails from boomers that have said like, you know, I lost my job 5 years ago and nobody wants to hire a 58-year-old. Even if you've got a lot of training, even if you're really good at your job, it just like you're somewhat tarnished by that age and nobody wants to get you into the workforce. And that's a real thing. Like boomers are suffering from a lot of the same things that we're suffering from. And there's some data that Xers actually had it the worst in the recession because they owned homes. They were much more likely to own homes than millennials were. So their homes lost all their value. And so the Xers who were like just getting onto the housing market just got hammered by the recession. Whereas you could make the argument that like people earlier in their career weren't as like they didn't lose as much of their wealth. They just lost opportunity, but Xers lost a lot of wealth. So I don't want to do like, I'm sorry if it came off as like generational warfare. I think everybody's getting affected by it. Can I ask you guys something though?
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, why did it resonate with you guys? Why did you guys want to talk to me?
Well, it's interesting you did say that about generational warfare, because that actually one of the questions I had towards the end is, can we all get along? Or is it, you know, that mindset of, well, if they have some of the pie, that's less pie for me. So that's one of the questions I had. But yeah, I think I was interested both as a millennial and I think as you speak to, and the question that came up while you were talking right there is it seems like there's as with anything, maybe we paint too broad of a brush, but it seems like there's actually generations within generations. So when you talked about in the article how folks who graduated in 2008 versus I think it was 2005, that was a $60,000 difference in opportunities just because there wasn't jobs out there.
Yeah.
I graduated in 2005, which makes me, I guess, now a dinosaur. So I kind of relate to
senior
both.
Senior millennial. You are also a senior millennial.
Right. So I relate to both stories. So it's kind of funny to me now that I remember a time before the internet. Thus, I can see the arc of the impact of the internet, even though I was, and I remember it was like an event. I've talked about this on the show. I was 14 and I remember like being all excited because we got the 26.6K modem. Like, and it was like, I watched it be installed and the cable guy had to come out. And now in 2017, installing my internet was basically two text messages. Like, do you have your modem? Yes. All right. It's been connected. Confirmed. Connect. And I was like, what the hell? And I'm able to see that whole picture. So it's actually a weird place to be. But I never realized, because you kind of think your story is everyone's story, that that was a unique experience. So I graduated in 2005 and it seemed like forever for me. But I had my first job after 6 months out of school.
Yeah.
And I thought even that was ridiculous. But how you were talking about these people who graduated in 2007, 2009 are still looking for steady work. That's insane to me. And I've had pretty much steady working since that time. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah. I mean, it resonated with me because so I also graduated in 2005. And so when I graduated, like I had a job. So even before I got out of school, like I knew what I was doing. And like that's what I got used to graduates expecting. That's the way it was for even classes that graduated. But for me, but what I found particularly interesting, and we may get to this somewhere in the discussion, is a lot of the talk about the housing markets, also the rise of contractors. So I work in Silicon Valley where contracting is a huge thing. And I actually have people on my team who are contractors as well. So talking to them about some of the challenges that they face, things like, you know, if they take any time off, vacation, family planning, anything, they don't get paid for it. They're on benefits that aren't the best. But you know, previously, I would also say to people that contracting could be a good foot in the door if there are no other opportunities available. But I read this and then I'm like, you know what? It could still be a good foot in the door, but it's a type of opportunity that not everyone is able to take on because there's no benefits. You might make a lower wage.
Yeah.
The overall job security isn't there because it's contingent labor. And it's just something that I see every day. Like Marcus, I've got that full arc. And I was going to say up front, like, I think one advantage that we do have, and I don't think it's so much entitlement, is that we do have technology and things can appear to be easier. But when you look at all of the financial factors, that's not the case. I mean, it's like certain things may be more convenient, but what it takes to make the same amount of money and some of the things that we have to look at taking on are things that I never had to think about. So I never thought about, like, you know, maybe I'll be a contractor going somewhere or maybe I'll have to take a lower wage. But, you know, I imagine if I graduated now or I graduated 2008, 2009, it would be a completely different story in terms of how I saw the workforce versus kind of like, yeah, you graduate, you get a job. And I feel like my class was one of the last few where that was the case.
I also graduated in 2003, and it makes sense to split the millennial generation almost into two, the pre-recession and post-recession. Like, so this guy I profile in the story, Scott, who graduated with an economics degree in 2009 and is now working as a bus driver because he could kind of never get on the ladder with his college degree. When he graduated, the year he graduated, there were six applicants for every job. And so it's not like Scott sucks or like Scott was not good at his interviews or like Scott should have like built his personal brand or like whatever, like little listicle advice that we've all been getting. It's like there just were too many of him and not enough jobs. And that happened to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I think the factors that were kind of beyond people's control, I think especially from 2008 to 2012, were just like this tsunami. And a lot of people just kind of never got back on the ladder. And so I, working on the story, I had never really felt lucky necessarily before. But it, once I started working on this and talking to people, the fact that I graduated 3 years before the recession and like I had a foothold on the ladder during the recession is like decisive. I mean, that might be the difference between me kind of making it and like me working as a bus driver right now. It's just I lucked out and I happened to graduate 3 years before the recession.
And it's crazy because I was working for a staffing agency in 2008, like right when the recession happened, I went into a commission-based job that was based off of how many people I could hire. And I mean, there was such a surplus of like people who were good at their job available. And it was anything from millennials to, I think, like I read an article or like we talked about earlier, you know, people who were 50 plus. And you had people who had, you know, 20 plus years of experience willing to take jobs that require 3 or 4 years of experience and take a pay cut, which, you know, for companies, I guess that's great where you have this huge pick. But I remember talking to people who they went from having this great situation to saying, look, I'll be happy to make half of what I was making just to be employed again. So when a company's choosing between, you know, folks that have all of these pedigree, all of these degrees and so on versus folks that are just out of school, they're going to get what they can get for that money. Mm. And I think that speaks to the whole thing of how, I don't know if I want to call it degree inflation, but we're like now, like you need a bachelor's degree to do even the most basic thing.
Yeah, to do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, like, you know, looking for someone with a bachelor's fresh out of school, 10 years of experience to, you know, wash dishes. I mean, that's probably not the best example, but that's kind of what you're seeing now where the most basic jobs require degrees and they're using that as a filter criteria because so many people are available.
What kind of millennials do you see applying for work now, working in staffing?
Well, now I work for a Silicon Valley tech company. So, I mean, I see a lot of like computer science people mainly is what I deal with. So I'm focused on engineering. But it's really across the board in terms of the types of background schools. Most of the folks that I see apply do come from a degree program. That's also a requirement for a lot of the roles that we hire for. Marcus, I'm not sure about you since you work in a bit of a different industry in terms of the type of people you're seeing apply.
Well, it's actually interesting you say that because I kind of see the same thing on the side of two millennials because I work in a niche field. So for those who are new to the show, I've been in audit for about 10 years. So we actually open up jobs. We have job opening right now that we can't fill. We're not getting enough applicants. And I've heard that description before where companies are like, yeah, we have, you know, usually it's STEM or something to it. And they're like, we have 50 jobs open and we got 40 applicants. And it's crazy to hear both sides of that story where now I think some of that is because of that degree inflation. A tweet that I saw, I think earlier this week was we want to hire a vice president with senior level experience for intern level pay. And it's like they're asking for a lot more. And, you know, Rich, when you kind of gave that example about contract work, it's almost like it's more of a purveyor belt than it is an escalator. Like back in the day, you could be on the contract and you would, you know, do that for 1, maybe 2 years and then you move up into the company. Whereas now it's just like your contract and then it renews and then it renews and then it renews. And suddenly you are just a contract worker, which is a different reality than I've known when I did contract work. And when I kind of observed the, what is it, the micro economy or whatever, the share economy, they call it now, all the Uber drivers and everything like that. And this goes back to being that older senior millennial. I had the perspective of, this actually looks scary to me because is this now the new normal that we won't pay people a livable wage? They'll just work 3 or 4 jobs. And, you know, it's in this book I read recently, Dollars and Cents, they called it the free agency economy, that you're never wed or tied to any employer because neither is loyal to one another.
Right. And also, I mean, so I interviewed a couple people about this, kind of like academics who would, they call it the fissured workplace, where a lot of people that are in the office aren't actually employees of the employer, right? So like Apple has like a cafeteria, but like that's, it's not Apple, it's like Cafeteria Inc. that's like running the cafeteria, right? Like it's all these like separate companies. Google bus drivers, all these kind of people. And that's one thing that the academics are seeing too, is that like you just, even when the company does well, so if you're working in the cafeteria at Apple, Apple all of a sudden, like their stock price spikes, you don't really get any benefit from that because you're not, obviously you don't own stock options. You're not really an employee of the company. You're just kind of selling them a service. So you're not like being pulled upward with them. You're like, they're still going to pay you exactly the same amount of money. They're not necessarily going to offer you like training opportunities. They're not going to offer you promotions. There's no kind of like track to get into the company. And nobody in the company would say, oh, like, I know him. He's great. Why don't we hire him for this job? There just isn't that kind of pulling like gravitational force anymore. And it's a structural change in the economy that you just don't have those companies like, you know, IBM or Kodak, where it's like, you know, the office, the people cleaning the office at night were Kodak employees. And so if there was another opportunity within the company, they could say, hey, I'm an internal hire. Why don't you hire me for this position in HR or whatever it was? You just don't have those kinds of tracks anymore.
And I agree, and I'm going to change dynamics here a little bit, but I wanted to also give some folks, and I'll put this in the show notes, but I like to give folks the numbers behind it. So the surprising statistic that jumped out for me, in addition to the one you just dropped on the show, was 42% of millennials are mothers, which I assume we do that a lot, but there's also fathers involved too. So there's 42% that are parents. I just didn't think it would be that high.
Yeah, it's but crazy, another, right?
Yeah. Another surprising statistic was 1 in 5 millennials live in poverty. And so the numbers I want to give to that for a one person family household, that's 11,000 a year. And I'll kind of jump around here up to 4, and I'll get this in the show notes. 4, that would be 24,000 a year. So poverty, as federally defined, is living on 24,000 for a family of 4 or 11,000 for a family of 1. And I'll go ahead and say 2 just in case there's children involved. That would be 15,000 for a household of 2. And then you also say that millennials won't be able, based on these numbers, or maybe you can help me understand, millennials won't be able to retire until age 75. The average lifespan is 78. Now, hopefully it goes up, but that sounds like a 3-year retirement plan there. How did you come up with that number?
Well, this is from, I forget where that one's from, but I think it's from a National Bureau of Labor Research statistic. That's from some statistical agency.
Okay.
But it's basically the fact that like you have to have somewhat of a nest egg saved up for you to retire. So there's different, like you guys would know this better than I would, but there's like different rubrics that you would use, right? That like you have to have enough saved up so that you pay out 80% of your income for 10 years. There's like different kind of forms of like formulas that you can use for this. And so because the saving rate for millennials right now, it's negative, but the idea is that basically because homes are so difficult to buy and so expensive, student debt is this huge weight around people's necks. We just don't end up saving as much as previous generations did. And so if you kind of extrapolate that out into the future, if the current trends continue, which I hope that they do not, right, we're basically, by the time you can save up enough to get 80% of your salary back for 10 years, it's going to take you an extra 10 years to do that. So it's just, we aren't putting in enough. And then the vicissitudes of compound interest, of course, you just don't get as much back. So yeah, that's basically how they come up with that.
Now, do you buy into the whole idea of lifestyle inflation for millennials, that part of the reason we're struggling is because we're all trying to keep up with each other and the appearances?
No, not at all. I mean, I think, I don't know. I think there's probably some of that, I suppose. But I think the really big things is, you know, housing, healthcare, and education are all more than 4 times more expensive for us than they were for our parents. And so I'm sure that like there's some lifestyle competition going on. I think that our grandparents probably did lifestyle competition when they were 25. I think our parents did lifestyle competition when they were 25. Mm-hmm. There's more things that we have to pay these days. I mean, our parents didn't have internet bills. Our parents didn't have phone bills that they had to pay. Like we just have more monthly costs. So no, I mean, I'm sure that like there's some of that going on. I think that 25-year-olds have kind of always been sort of status oriented or too status oriented more than they should be. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that that is like more important than the structural stuff, things like student loan debt that our parents just simply didn't have to deal with.
Got it.
And I think there's 2 things, or probably at least 3, that I think contextually important here is, even statistically across every generation, most people don't start thinking about savings, retirement, you know, family planning until about age 34. There was a study that I read about that. I think
stop
the difference
putting me on
is,
blast, Marcus.
Well, I think the difference is now if you started thinking about all those things at 34, you might have $37,000 in debt, $16,000 in credit card debt if you're the average household. And I'll drop that quote in there from NerdWallet. Whereas if you started thinking about that at 35 and you were a boomer, you might have a pension plan. So even if you didn't like it, you might have had money being put aside for you by your employer. The third point that I want to talk about, and just to give some numbers to that, this was surprising to me, but 70% of expenses are just 3 categories pretty much across the nation. That's home, food, and transportation. And no matter what city, I have to get the study that just did this, 50% was home and transportation in every major city they studied. So 50% of expenses are literally where you live, and then mostly probably going to be trying to afford to get to work so you can pay for where you live.
Dude, I know. I after the article came out, this single mom in Houston got in touch with me, and I just chatted to her on the phone yesterday. And she was like breaking down her finances for me, that like her rent is $800 a month, and her car payments are like $500 a month. Insurance is another $150, and gas is another $100. And so her car takes up almost as much as her rent. And you hear this across the country where the public transport really isn't good enough to get to work. So there's really no other option, especially if you live in one suburb and work in another. Oftentimes there just aren't suburb to suburb public transit. And so you're kind of stuck paying almost as much as your rent for your car just so that you can work to afford your car. I mean, this is you find this commonality everywhere.
And that's one of the, or one of the questions I want to have is, you talk a little bit about this, is the 401k going to save us or kill us? So you say here in the coming decades, or at least the article, in the coming decades, the return on 401s are expected to fall by half. And that's from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? It doesn't sound good.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think that there's this like this human thing where you think that there's like a normal and there's like a deviation from normal. And, you know, normal is like America in like the 50s and 60s when like living standards were booming. And now we've deviated from that and we can like go back to the normal. But actually, that period where living standards were rising so quickly kind of is the deviation. And we're kind of going back, like now is the normal when we've got growth is pretty slow. Stock returns are fine, but not like booming. Living standards aren't really going anywhere. And my understanding is that most kind of conservative estimates of the economy over the next 20, 30 years are that like we're going to stay on this kind of slow growth trajectory and you're just not going to have these booms in the stock market that our parents had. And what's interesting is, you know, it all kind of comes down to like the dark side of compound interest that like everyone's always telling you because compound interest is so great, you should start saving when you're 23. But then once the stock prices go down, because of also because compound interest is so powerful, a drop of stock income returns from 7% to 5% means you have to double how much you save because you're missing out on all that extra compound interest over the decades. So it basically means that like if this is true, and like I'm always very skeptical of anything that projects that far out into the future, so who knows? But if what economists are saying turns out to be true, we all need to be saving more than double what we're saving now to get the same, you know, 80% of our income back that our parents did. And so that's a very scary future, especially when you think about the fact that Social Security is already under threat. And just demographically, there's going to be a lot fewer workers for each retiree by the time we're 65. And so all of these kind of come together. I know I'm being really depressing right now, but all of these things come together to just show that there's going to be less free money when we're old, and we're going to get less of our own money back when we're old too, which is like a really scary thing to think about.
Well, I mean, now mind you, I might be in the minority here, but I think information is also power, and thus by extension, ignorance is bliss. And people who know my pen name know what I used to write under, and that would be wisdom is misery. So I think it's helpful to know because an adjustment has to be made. So I'd rather know this information at 35 than I'm what working till 75. And then somebody's, oh, by the way, 30 years ago, you should have been saving 22%.
Totally. Instead of
15.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, so I think it's powerful to have this information and then talk about what change we have. And I'm going to try to salvage it here at the end. We talked about it in the black box before the show started that I think there's some positives that can change. And what I would say is, it's going to fall on the shoulders of millennials to make those changes. And what is that going to look like for us? One of the things that your article notes that I thought did really well, first of all, kudos to you and whomever assisted you. This article was very well researched and I thought very balanced instead of just here's what's wrong with millennials. They eat too much avocado toast and buy too many phones. Yeah. So it notes that the responsibility across all generations has shifted from a shared society, government employers to the individual. And I don't think most people realize the dynamic of that change. Even the what they call the grandfather of the 401k said the 401k was never supposed to be the primary vehicle for retirement. It was actually be the third leg of the stool. It was supposed to be pension, retirement, Social Security.
Yeah.
Now, if we're lucky, it's Social Security and 401.
Yeah.
What are your kind of thoughts or short or long term impacts on that change? Well, first of all, do you agree with that assessment? And then what are your thoughts on that change?
I heard the three-legged stool thing from some of the economists that I interviewed too, that it was kind of, I mean, it's interesting to me the extent to which we sort of like sleepwalked into this scenario where there's been all these changes, really structural, deep changes to the economy. But like, since they all happened sort of piecemeal and they all happened sort of step by step, it doesn't seem like anyone really noticed that they were happening. It's like we've gotten into this place where like union representation has gone from 33% to 11%. The gig economy is now up to 40% of workers. I mean, we've got all these like structures that have changed, but because they've done so slowly, no one has really like sounded the alarms. And so I think retirement is one of those areas where we just have sleepwalked into the situation where it's like we're all relying on 401ks. One of the things I heard from a lot of the economists I interviewed was that the nice thing about, you know, a defined benefit pension, right, where you get X% of your income back in retirement, like the thing that like people in the military have. Nobody has those anymore. So it used to be like 60% of the workforce, and now it's like 10, 12% of the workforce. But one of the nice things about those pensions was that you couldn't draw them down in an emergency. They were like something you were entitled to, but they weren't yours until you retired. Whereas one thing that you found, especially during the recession, is that a lot of workers drew down their 401ks because they had to. They needed it for emergency funds. And so now, of course, they're missing out on the compound interest and everything else. So it's, of course, completely understandable that they drew down those 401ks, but because that was an option for them, it allowed them to be used as a rainy day fund, which is really not what retirement savings is for. And so a lot of people have gotten into this situation where they just don't have as much retirement, and now they're missing out on all this compound interest that they would have gotten otherwise.
Yeah. And so one question I have for you is, could you define a little bit of what the gig economy is? Mm-hmm. I'm loosely familiar, but for folks who aren't, right, might be myself as well.
What's interesting is that, you know, we talk a lot about the gig economy and Uber and, you know, Airbnb and these kind of things. And that's kind of the dictionary definition of the gig economy. It's something like Uber, where it's like you as a side gig, as moonlighting, like I can become an Uber driver tomorrow and like do that a couple hours a week and like it's a little bit of extra income. How nice. And that's kind of like the promise of the gig economy. But the gig economy is actually only 3% of American workers. And a lot of people are actually doing it as a full-time job, which the companies themselves say it really isn't intended to be, because you're not getting health coverage, you're not getting all these other benefits. A much larger structural change in the economy is what they call domestic outsourcing. And that's what I talked about earlier, where the cafeteria employees at Apple are not Apple employees. And so that is up to 40% of workers. So one of the guys that wrote the book on this, David Weil, he told me that when he worked at the Department of Labor, they would investigate companies that were doing this kind of thing. And what he found was that you'd have these big office towers, like 20 floors, and they would split each floor into kind of its own unit, and they would hire a different contractor to clean each one of those floors at night. So instead of having, you know, 1,000 employees that are all your employees that are cleaning this office building, you're subcontracting with 15 different companies, and you don't actually know what the working conditions are. So when he would talk to these companies and say, you know, a lot of these people are not being paid for overtime, they're not being paid fair wages, the companies would say, well, we don't know. It's not really our problem. We're just hiring contractors. So it's not our responsibility. And so that is up to 40% of the workforce now. I mean, it's something like 10% of, it's 40% of federal employees are actually contractors. It's like people like symphony orchestra players are hired as contractors now. And that gets a lot less attention in the gig economy because it's less like new and less like technical. But it's a huge shift in the economy that like bus drivers and all these other people are not employees of the companies they're really working for.
And why is that? Did you get into the motivation for companies to hire contractors versus employees?
Yeah, it's really, really, really simple. It's cheap.
Yeah.
When you would know the numbers better than I would, but my understanding is a full-time employee, you have to pay their salary and then 15% extra,
yep,
for unemployment benefits, Social Security, all these other benefits. And healthcare is like bananas expensive for direct employees. There's those costs too. Whereas if you're hiring contractors, you can have the same hourly rate or maybe even a little bit more hourly rate. But if you're not giving them healthcare and you're not giving them all these other benefits, it's wildly cheaper. It's also much easier to get rid of them. You don't have to do any severance or anything like that. And so this was this poor kid that I interviewed who got fired from his job after missing 3 days of work in 5 months of employment. And nobody actually told him that there's a three strikes policy for missing work. But just all of a sudden, he was told, don't come in today. And it's much easier to do that if you're using temps than if you have employees where basically you have to provide them with stuff. So David Weil, the guy that wrote the book on this, the quote that he gave me was like, it's an arrangement designed for non-compliance. Like that's why you do it, is so that you don't have to comply with labor laws.
It's actually insane because I mentioned earlier that I manage contractors, and that whole arrangement is just like weird to me. Like you go through the interview process, bring somebody in. And if you want to get rid of somebody who's a cop, literally all you do is just call their agency and tell them not to come back the next day.
Exactly. It's bananas. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I notice out here, I know another benefit of it is just it being able to easily roll with the, and I'll put this in air quotes, business conditions where the business is doing great.
Right.
Okay. We can afford to bring on more contractors. We're trying to grow. Business is doing not so well. There's some numbers that we need to show and prove. Let's just cut all these people who are contributing, just like pretty much everyone else across the company that's considered an employee. So it's like, I understand the business reason behind it, but then it also just feels, I don't want to say impersonal, but it feels like it loses some of the human element in the process.
Oh, totally. It also, you know, very strongly individualizes the risk too, that it used to be if there was an economic downturn or if, you know, that company didn't have enough customers that day or that week or whatever, it was kind of part of the company's like business model that like they had to keep paying their employees, right? And they just had to have a healthy business model that on slow days, they still had to pay their employees the same amount. But with all these contractors and contingent arrangements, all of a sudden it's on you. So if the company doesn't have enough customers that week, they can just tell you not to come in that day and you don't get paid.
Yeah.
And so all of the risk of their business model is now your risk as an individual. So there's no safety net to kind of catch you if all of a sudden tomorrow they just say, sorry, no one wants our product this week. Don't come in.
Yeah. And another thing, people may know this about contractors, but so if the company is closed for a holiday, contractors don't necessarily get like holiday pay. So there are some companies that are very generous about that, where they'll say, you know what, even though the company is going to be closed, we want to make sure that contractors are paid holiday pay. But in a lot of cases, like, for example, if the company does like a shutdown for a week, the employees may still get paid. But if you're a contractor, you're just pretty much crap out of luck, you know, which is something else.
Yeah. And that's exactly why they do it, right? Like, it's cheaper for them. They save, whatever, $1,000 by not paying their contractors that week. And like, that is 100% why they do it. And so it's not surprising that they do it. But it's also just, you know, capitalism. All these companies just want to squeeze costs as much as possible. And so it's not particularly surprising that they do it, but it's taken over far too much of the economy.
Right.
And a question that I had here, and I think this is all good, but what does it mean? Is there like this inevitable, clearly written on the wall, Civil War, you know, Marvel, Marvel versus the other one that I can't think of right now for, yeah, there we go, for entitlements and expectations of the generations. Can we coexist? Like, you know, is it my pie versus their pie? Uh-huh. What do we do here?
So this is like the part that I love talking about the most, which is like all the fixes to it. So in the same way that like we sleepwalked into the situation that we have now, like step by step, we can get out of it the same way. We can reverse every single one of those steps. So the main problem with contingent work is that one kind of employee, direct employees, are very expensive, and one kind of employees, contractors, are very cheap. And there's nothing in between, right? It's like there's the expensive kind and the cheap kind. So obviously companies are hiring more of the cheap kind because they are cheap. What we need to do is make every employee cost the same. And so there's these models called portable benefits where if a company wants to rely on contractors because they want to be more flexible, blah, 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 whatever, fine. But they still have to pay you 15% extra. So whether you work there 1 hour or 1 week or 1 year, you get 15% extra, and that goes into a fund that is yours that follows you from job to job to job. And if you get sick, if you need holidays, if you need unemployment, whatever, you can draw down out of that fund. And so the most important thing is that the company pays that. It's not coming out of your paycheck. It's coming out of their payment for you. And that way, direct employees aren't actually all that much more expensive than contractors. And that takes away the reason to hire contractors. And if you do want to hire contractors anyway, fine, have a blast. But you have to pay them the same premiums that you're paying for your full-time employees. And there's already industries that have this. There's already states that have a version of this. This is not like some science fiction crazy idea. This is common sense, and it's the kind of thing that you could very easily legislate. There's even a proposal for this by Mark Warner, one of these senators, that of course is going to go nowhere because that's our politics, but you can do this on the state level. You can do this locally. You can, and you know, if the Democrats get back into power, I think we can pressure them to put something in place to start to even this out, because it makes no sense that we have this binary distinction between expensive employees and cheap employees, and there's no like graduated scale.
And I somewhat understand that, but is it really, I don't feel like it's Republican Democrats, because we are both in this contract, in this gig economy, and in this particular issue, it seems, heaven forbid in this environment, bipartisan. is it really a you know, a blue and red, or is that just the environment that we exist in right now, where that might have to be the way that it rolls out?
Well, I mean, to me, this is like very common sense and bipartisan. And in other countries, there are bipartisan plans for this. So Canada and Germany have something called a dependent contractor. So it's one level below an independent contractor, where if you're getting more than 50% of your income from one company, that company actually is responsible for you in some like ways that are a little bit smaller than being fully responsible for you. Like, whether the company likes it or not, if they are the bulk of your income, they have to take care of you in these specific ways. So they're not completely breaking down the binary distinction, but they're basically creating an in-between status where there's contractors, dependent contractors, and then employees. And so that's something that is a bipartisan thing. That's something that the center left and the center right parties in those countries have agreed on. And I think it's a very common sense thing to do here. It's something that's kind of on the road to getting us to some sort of portable benefits model. But I have not seen any Republican action on that. I've seen some Democrat action on that. So yeah, so I'd love it if that was a bipartisan thing, but it doesn't appear to me that it is a bipartisan thing at this point.
Now, mind you, bipartisan this day and age might be 52-1, but you know, that would be a step in the right direction. It actually be further than we moved to date.
Yeah.
So what solutions along those lines do you see within millennials' controls versus would require outside help? And what is that demographic, 18 to 34 now? So yeah. 18 to 34-year-olds, what can we do either today, 2018, or in the next few years to make that impact?
So one of like the few like bright rays of hope that I came across writing this was what's happening in cities. I mean, you've seen mayors and governors become really proactive on these kinds of issues. And so, as I mentioned, California has this plan that helps contractors a little bit. You've had minimum wage hikes in, I'm going to get the number wrong, but something like 13 states and cities have passed minimum wage hikes. Another, I think it's 11 states and cities have passed sick leave protection. So I live in Seattle, where you're statutorily required to give your employees sick leave, which is great. 'Cause like, I don't want like waitresses and like people around like being contagious. Like, it's just really, really, really obvious that people should be able to stay home when they're sick. So there's a lot of action that cities are doing. San Francisco has this thing to prevent companies from scheduling you with no advance notice. That's something that makes it really hard to have two jobs, is if you're working 30 hours a week, but your schedule changes every week and you only get it 2 days in advance. It's really hard to like plan your life or go to school or do anything else. And they're saying you have to have 2 weeks notice. You have to employ workers for a minimum number of hours per week so they get a steady income, and they have the right to apply for change. Like, they can kind of complain about changes or change the changes if you're giving them to them in very short notice, which is like, again, very common sense. Like, this isn't radical socialism. This is just like basic making people's lives better. So there is actually a ton of stuff going on at the local level. And I think for millennials now, the federal situation is just like a Ferris wheel of darkness. But there's actually a lot that you can do locally. So one of the things I mentioned in the article was that when my dad bought a house, he was earning like $75,000 adjusted for inflation, and his first house cost him $125,000 adjusted for inflation, which is, when you think about it now, is bananas, right? That he would pay less than 2 years of his salary for a house. Like, for our generation, that's like, awooga, that makes no sense.
Yeah. It's funny because the first thing I thought is about the cost of housing in the Bay Area. I was like, what? That's like...
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, you guys are even worse than us. Like, in Seattle, it's bad. I would have to work like 10 years to afford a house, but you guys would have to work like 30. Like, it's completely nuts down there.
Yeah.
But so that like little snippet that was in the article about my dad and buying a house, I gave that as testimony to the Seattle City Council, because they're doing all these upzones. They're upzoning and making buildings taller here, which increases the number of houses, which hopefully will reduce the rents. And like, that's something that I've gotten really involved in since I moved back here, is showing up at these hearings and testifying and writing to my congressperson about housing and my city council member. Like, I write my city council members constantly. And there really is a lot you can do locally. And it's very easy to get involved, because small numbers of people locally can have a huge impact. I mean, just a city council member getting, you know, 30, 75, 100 emails can be enough to change their mind. And so you don't need these like Women's March, million people on the streets type of events to actually change policy. And so I really hope that millennials start running for office, start finding out who is in charge of these things, which committees are in charge, and showing up. It sucks. Like, you have to take time off work. Oftentimes they're at like 2 p.m. Like, they're not set up for great public participation.
Especially
if you're a contractor. But I'm lucky in that I work from home, so I do have some of this time to do it. But even if you don't have time to do it, you can be calling, you can be writing. And, you know, we're all calling our senators constantly to like ask them not to take our health care. But you can, that's good. We should keep doing that. But then you can also interact with your city council members, and they're much more accessible, and you can have a real effect on policy. And it's really important to start doing that stuff.
Now, is there a place people can generally start if they're looking to get more involved? So I'm sure there's something that ends in .gov or .whatever the state is, but is there somewhere that people can generally go to find out, you know, where the people are, who they need to contact, where the efforts are happening, where the council meetings are happening? I mean, it sounds super obvious. You could probably Google it, but is there like a general place that people should get started?
That's a good question. I know there's websites that you can put in your zip code and they'll tell you all of your reps, which I think is just good to like add those to your contacts and like know generally, like follow all them on Twitter, follow them all on Facebook, just kind of like be involved in knowing what they're up to and like start holding them to account and like write to them just like to check in and be like, hey, I'm one of your constituents. These are my issues. What I've sort of done actually is like housing is like my current huge obsession. And so that's like my issue. There's a million other issues in Seattle that I'd like to be working on, but like time is limited. And so I just picked like, I'm like, all right, housing, like this year, I'm just gonna like work my ass off on housing. And so I go to these hearings, I go to events, I email people about housing stuff. And so I think for millennials, you know, you can't solve every single problem and like it's not up to us to save the world ultimately. But what you can do is pick like an issue that you're really concerned about, income inequality, voting rights, criminal justice, whatever it is, and just like dig into that issue, like find the committees, find the people and just like pester them and get like hella annoying until you start to see results. Find out what the NGOs are. There's so many civil society organizations, especially now when everybody's like getting so up in arms about everything. There's 100% already a civil society organization in your city that is like more pissed off about your issue than you are. And like start hanging out with those people. Like go have lunch with those people, go have coffee with those people, ask them what you can do. I'm an animator, and so I made an animation earlier this year for like this advocacy organization that's working on like urbanism. Like that's something I could do because that's like a skill that I have. Like whatever skill you have, you can probably donate that to your issue. I just think it's so easy to get discouraged about stuff at the national level because it's like objectively discouraging. But locally, it's actually great. I mean, like I've met my city council members a number of times. I've met the Seattle mayor a couple times. Like these people are pretty accessible. So you just have to kind of like go to these things and you're like, oh, hey, this is the mayor. I can go say, hi, I'm a constituent. It, you know, you don't need to be like a powerful person and get into their office. You can actually have access to these people. So I would recommend everybody start doing that. And like, it's amazing what we can do if we just kind of like start putting forth the effort.
Yeah. The other piece I was going to say to Rich's question, I don't think there's a centralized resource, but the great irony is most of this is public record. So when they have those committees and those notices, they have to post it. I mean, that's pretty much a requirement. I think that is a requirement of every city.
But yeah,
for most cities, they have to post it like, you know, next week at 2 p.m. when you're at work, we will be discussing this boring issue that if you wanted to come and see, you could. And for the most part, I mean, I haven't researched them all, but City of Austin is City of Austin and City of Denver is City of Denver. So yeah, they're not that difficult to find. You know, government's not that clever. So if you search local city committees, it might be yourcity.com or .gov or .org or what actually whatever's left. Because I think City of Denver was .org because somebody was smart enough to steal .gov from them before that. And then another irony of it is the model already exists. They're a dinosaur now, but they're pretty entrenched and they're police, fire and sheriff. Police, fire and sheriff are typically county or city funded and they have pensions and they have unions, very powerful ones. And so these models not only exist, they exist in areas where you'll be going to the representatives to talk about, well, why can't we do this for our constituents, the people who elected you and technically pay your salary?
Yeah.
So I think we're getting towards the wrap up here. I told you in the beginning before we started the show anyway, I kind of had a hot seat question, but any comments that you have, is there anything else that you want to plug before we get to that?
I have nothing to plug. I have no things.
So
I'm going to the holidays. I'm planning on seeing Star Wars. Like this, these are the rest of my plans for this year, basically.
Yeah, that's a rabbit hole in itself. So I've never sat through or watched a complete Star Wars movie before.
Oh my gosh.
Which gets many scoffs and looks of scorn.
Yeah.
Until this one that I saw the other day.
Oh.
I'm not going to spoil it. I have my thoughts.
Okay.
What I will say that may send shockwaves through the internet is I wasn't all that impressed, but
Oh, man. But, enjoy those emails.
But it's gotten a lot of positive reviews, so I hope you enjoy that experience. Okay. And there may be some things that we have to discuss afterwards.
Right. If I can plug something, my Twitter is insufferable, but that's the best place to find me. It's Rotten in Denmark.
Oh.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that. Why Rotten in Denmark? Not that I'm willing to talk with the various Twitter names I've had.
Because I lived in Denmark for 6 years. I feel like one of the best kept secrets of like the globe is that master's degrees, like graduate school, is free in all the Scandinavian countries. So because I couldn't afford to do graduate school in the United States, I went to Denmark to do it. And it's in English. So that was why I moved there. I moved there in 2005. And then I ended up getting an unpaid internship because I'm a millennial. And that ended up turning into a job, actually. And then I ended up working there for 6 years. So I spent most of my 20s in Denmark, actually.
Oh, and I also thought you meant that your Twitter name was insufferable. I was like, that's
oh, no, my Twitter content is insufferable. My Twitter name is Rotten in Denmark.
Yeah, and I had seen that before because I tracked him down for the show, stalked him in the DMs, and here we are.
Yeah.
I actually think you hit on this. So the hot seat question was going to be, and so normally when I have someone on for personal finance, I ask them for their one personal finance guru, proverb, lesson learned. So your area of focus and your 8 months of research, what would be your one tip for our millennial listeners who want to make an impact, difference, or change in 2018 in their lives and fellow millennials?
I would say, like I said, pick an issue and get to know your reps and just like bug the hell out of them.
Simple enough. Simple enough.
I also, this is totally random thing and you guys might disagree with me, but on a personal level, I do feel like the best financial decision I ever made was I quit drinking when I was like 29.
I disagree. I disagree. Yeah. Yeah.
That might be worse than saying I don't like Star Wars. I don't know. Yeah. But I just think, I mean, my finances aren't like perfect or anything, but when I think about like all the nights out, like an $80 night out, you know, if you're drinking, I haven't had one of those since like 2011. And so I can't tell everybody to stop drinking, but as a financial decision, not drinking is extremely prudent.
It's probably saved you a lot of bad decisions.
Also has done that. A lot of like texts at like 2 a.m. it has saved me those too.
And actually, you're right. I'll get into the show notes. There was a Time article that summarized how much people on average spend on drinking. I mean, it's in the thousands. I can tell you that very easily. It's in the thousands a year. So I'll get that in the show notes. So you are correct, but I won't be doing it myself. But right, it's inspirational enough for, you know, our fellow millennials, you know, this is New Year's resolution season. More power to you. You let me know how it goes.
Yeah, give it a shot.
And the website is rottenindenmark.wordpress.com. Is there anywhere else that people can find you besides Twitter?
Yeah, there's links. There's links on Twitter. Yeah,
I'll get that in the show notes. Michael, it's been great. I appreciate you for coming on the show.
Thanks, fellas.
As we promised, an informative and an entertaining show. So millennials, I hope you are inspired for those New Year's resolutions. This will drop before Christmas, so have a Merry Christmas. Get those New Year's going. 2018 is our year. The millennials shall inherit the earth.
Yes, and we definitely encourage you to go check out the full article that Michael wrote. It's super interactive, too. There's like scrolling things and cartoon images and all sorts of other stuff. It is a fairly long read. It took me a bit, but I'd say the animation definitely made it an enjoyable experience. And I mean, it was an easy read regardless that I related to a lot.
Yeah, definitely worth it a little bit to get through. I think he said, actually, I'm not going to say how many words he told us after the podcast because I want you to go over and read it. And I feel like if I just tell you, you'll be like, that's longer than a tweet. I'm not even going to bother. No, no, it's worth it. It's interactive. It's a good read. It's informative. Check it out.
Cool, man. And so if you've enjoyed today's episode or found it useful, be sure to share and hit us with those 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. As we always say, the more people we reach, the more people we help. And so when you let people know we're worth listening to, that increases the likelihood that they check the podcast out. And also, again, shout out to our top tier PNB patrons, Stephanie S., Chisholm O., and Michael M. We appreciate you and appreciate all the support that we've received this year. And again, looking forward to what's to come in 2018. But it looks like we do have a review to read this week.
And if you'd like to enter, many will enter, few will win. For an opportunity to get your 5-star review read, visit paychecksandbalances.com/review.
Yes.
This week's 5-star review comes from E3366. At this point, I almost feel like they're making names up just to mess with us. Do you know what this means? E-double?
Yo, I mean, I'm just going to go that this is like as straightforward as we're going to get. There's no like symbols that have to be converted to words. So E-double 366, not sure what it means. I'm just going to go with it being a name. and hope that that's it. But I'm sure they'll clarify.
This podcast is useful and entertaining, and I'm glad I started listening to this. I learned useful, practical lessons that seem obvious, but being human, I do not get it right! Exclamation mark used correctly. Shout out to E3666, a pseudonym that we think is just a name.
Yes, yes. And so, if you want to get us a holiday gift for the year, you know, a 5-star review would be cool. No pressure. But if not, again, thanks to everyone for listening. Completely understand. Until next year, be safe. We out. Peace.